From KCRW in Santa Barbara, I'm Jonathan Bastian, and this is the 805, Stories from the Central Coast. 1 year ago this week, torrential rain pelted the Santa Barbara County hillside community of Montecito that had been scorched a month earlier by wildfire. It unleashed a flow of mud and boulders the size of cars. Video footage shows resident Marco Farrell shouting at a driver from his front door just seconds before the wall of debris came flooding down the road.
Turn around! The flash flood's right there! The flash flood's right there! Get out of here! Go! Oh my God, Mom! Close the door! Wake Dad up!
23 people died that day, including a toddler and a teenager whose bodies were never recovered. This week, we'll check in with the community 1 year later and also talk about what's being done to prevent another debris flow, especially as we head into what meteorologists are predicting will be an El Niño winter. We'll start in downtown Montecito, where a candlelight procession was held on Wednesday night. KCRW producer Catherine Barnes attended and joins me now to tell us more. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Jonathan.
So what happened Wednesday? Because I've heard from a lot of folks that there was a pretty huge turnout.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how many people would come to this, but I'd say anywhere between 1 and 2,000, maybe even more than 2,000 people were there. They were mostly Montecito residents, although there were shuttles that came from Santa Barbara and Carpinteria bringing people who also wanted to participate. And everyone gathered starting at Lower Manning Park, which is a park right by the YMCA in Montecito. And it was really beautiful. They had these huge globe lights shining. They had these big beam lights that were shining up into the air, so you could actually see these lights all over Santa Barbara. There was also a stage in the middle of the park, and people gathered around that stage where a group of elementary school students sang "This Little Light of Mine." A member of the county's behavioral wellness team read a poem. A Chumash family from Montecito chanted some traditional songs. One extremely powerful moment was when Carrie Corey came up on stage. She lives in Montecito and lost two daughters in the mudslide.
My three daughters and I were sleeping in our home. Our house was washed away with us inside. My daughter Summer and I were miraculously found and rescued. We both sustained life-threatening injuries. Summer's twin sister Sawyer, age 12, and big sister Morgan, age 25, died in this tragedy. We are broken beyond words.
Yeah, it's a powerful, sobering voice, and it just made me think. I mean, Catherine, what was the mood of the event? Was it a sad one, kind of what we heard there, or a hopeful one, or how would you describe the evening?
It was very sad at many times. Obviously, when Carrie was speaking about her daughters who died, you know, she read a poem that her 12-year-old daughter Sawyer had written before she died. And, you know, looking out at the crowd, there were people crying. There were just people looking down and kind of mourning these losses. A group of residents, including the head of the Bucket Brigade, they came on stage and read the names of those who died. And we've read those names here on KCRW, too. But to kind of relive that a year later and to not forget those names was, I think, important for people. A high school student who lost her brother and father in the debris flow, she sang Amazing Grace. But overall, I think people came to this thing not just to mourn losses, but to kind of feel this sense of community, you know? Because in Montecito, it's kind of this place of lots of gated homes and long driveways and large estates. Sometimes you don't truly know who your neighbor is or have lots of one-on-one interactions with them. And I think people are realizing that they'll be stronger next time there's a big storm if they really do know their neighbor and stick together and help one another out. One person I spoke with was the local elementary school superintendent, Anthony Renai. Not only were his students affected by the mudslide, but the school was shut down for weeks since it was in the evacuation zone. Here's what he had to say.
I'm thinking about everybody who lost and everybody who's rebuilding. And when I say lost, yes, that's lost loved ones, lost a house, lost a dog, lost a job, lost a car. But I'm also thinking of how much this community is moving forward. And, you know, for the most part, hopeful. That doesn't mean that those that lost family members are done grieving. That doesn't mean that we don't have work to do. But mostly I'm filled with hope that at the end of this, you know, in some ways we'll be stronger for it. Of course, we're devastated that it happened. But considering it happened, I think Montecito is done an amazing job.
And it's interesting, Catherine, because if you head to Montecito's downtown, Coast Village Road, it feels like things are starting to feel like they're back to normal. We spent some time there earlier this week and spoke with a couple of business owners. One was Richie Ramirez, who runs Richie's Barbershop. He told me the recovery process has been amazing, especially considering what the place looked like when he first returned.
I wasn't sure if Montecito was ever going to get back to it. Still isn't. I mean, we're still only 80% back. But just where we are now is huge.
When you say 80%, do you mean kind of businesses aren't back at 100%, or there's still a lot of building that needs to be done? What
yes.
do you think?
So not people. There's a lot of people who are displaced from their homes, and those homes still aren't back yet. So Montecito was at 10,000 people. Now we're down to like 7,000. And another thing is we didn't get the tourism that we got this year. Usually in the past, a lot of people didn't come back. But the people who are here have been really supportive.
Yeah. So do you think that businesses have been impacted by that over this last year? Just less people around?
Definitely. There's been four or five businesses that on this road that have closed up after the mudslides.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been devastating to a lot of people.
You know, as we are at the 1 year mark, are there ever just reminders to you of the kind of crazy thing that happened and the catastrophe? Or are there days that pass now where you can kind of move on and life feels normal?
I mean, definitely every day is you're reminded just from people coming in and saying, hey, I drove up where the mudslides were. I saw it. It's still, it's hard to see. And we have so many clients that were affected, people who died in the mudslides, and their families come in every, it's just like seeing them, and it's hard, it's such a close knit community here that it's hard to see, it's so you're reminded every day.
Yeah. I mean, as I come here, what I see are the kind of some of the good signs. New businesses are opening right next to yours, for example. But what I'm hearing is that below that, there's still a trauma there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The new business, that's been great. This whole street's kind of getting revitalized. But there's still, you can't forget. You have to, you can never forget what happened. So,
well, Richie Ramirez, owner of Richie's here in downtown Montecito, thanks, and good luck to you this year.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Just a block down the road sits a bakery called Janine's. It's become a community center after the mudslide hit, and in many ways, it continues to be. It's lunchtime, and the restaurant is busy, but I asked owner Allison Hardy if things feel back to normal.
Well, as you can see, we are back to sort of a appearance of normal, and we have been busier than, like this holiday, we were busier than we thought. However, I think we're coming out of a very tumultuous time, and we're healing. But for the most part, the energy has been incredibly resilient and positive, and a lot of people have been very action-oriented.
Janine's played a really interesting role post-mudslide. I mean, this is where a lot of people were gathering, they were meeting, they were coming up with ideas. How did this place kind of become the local command station for engaged citizens? Because that's really what happened.
Well, it's difficult for me to talk about because I'm talking about myself and I don't like doing that. But the truth is, the street was dead. There was nobody on this street. When they finally opened it up so you could come on the train, you could actually get on the street, and there was nothing open. Everything was shut down. Everything that was here was just pretty much dump trucks. So when I first came here, I thought, somebody's got to open. Somebody's got to almost go run at the bear and turn to the mountains and say, we're not going anywhere. And I think through that, we became the touchstone for people to say, oh, that's the only place you can get food. Oh, that's the only place I can get information. There was really nowhere to go except for the Red Cross. And they were located in Santa Barbara. They weren't relocated where the tragedy happened, because it really happened right in here.
That's what's incredible. As I sit here, it feels like at least a large portion of Montecito is back. There is light. There are people on the streets. It's packed. In your mind, though, is Montecito back? Are we back at 100% yet?
No. Absolutely not. Commercially, fiscally, this has been the toughest year. We've been in business 30 years. This is by far, we've never seen a year like this, and hopefully we'll never see a year like that again. But it has a ripple effect, and commercially, we've taken a pretty big hit. The thing that I see, Jonathan, that's critical to us rebounding at 100% or maybe even greater are these protective measures.
Is there anything else you would like to see happen here in Montecito? Any other changes or kind of a dream you would push forward for this place?
I think an educational piece that goes into our schools, because the debris flow happened, we've had several of them in 1969. We've had some smaller ones in the 80s, I believe. I think an educational piece that goes into our geology, you know, in our geology classes, so that they know that this is our history and what this community did to offset it and what we continue to do, which is to maintain the creek beds and the waterways. I think that's critical, because I think we can go back into, oh, it'll never happen again. And, you know, that's kind of what happened, is we let everything just, we just assume it would never happen here, but it actually has. But we don't have to be caught off guard. We could actually have better systems in place, and that's education.
Well, Allison Hardy, owner of Janine's, nice to see you down here on a sunny Montecito morning, and best of luck to you in 2019.
Absolutely. Thank you. We could use it.
Coming up, we'll hear about one protective measure that Allison and others hope will prevent another debris flow. And later, this week of massive waves and rainy weather could only be the beginning, as meteorologists say it could be another El Nino winter. What that means for the Central Coast after this short break. This is KCRW. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Rain showers and thunderstorms like the ones we're seeing this week used to bring relief for drought-stricken Santa Barbara. But after the mudslides in Montecito a year ago, many residents still feel nervous and anxious every time they see an approaching storm. Curious Coast producer Ted Mills is back in the studio to answer a question from one such person. Hey, Ted.
Hey, Jonathan.
All right, let's get right down to it here. A listener from Ventura County asked us this question.
My name is Cassandra C. Jones, and I'm from Ojai, California. Here is my question. Could mudslides happen again during the next big rain? And if so, how long before that is no longer a threat? I can't think of anything scarier than the possibility of something like that happening again in the same area. I have friends there, and I worry about them.
Okay, Ted, that's what Cassandra wants to know, so what can you tell her?
Well, I spent the past months speaking with fire chiefs, county department heads, and representatives about this, and the short answer is yes, mudslides can still very much happen. That was impressed upon me from everybody. There's always that possibility. One expert I spoke with was on the front lines during the debris flow. That's Santa Barbara City Fire Chief Pat McElroy. He was all set to retire when the flood happened, and here's what he had to say.
As long as you have this completely burned landscape, with these type of mountains that we have here, and what one geologist said is an inexhaustible supply of debris, we're still at risk until the vegetation grows back and the hillsides stabilize.
And everyone I spoke with said it'll take another 4 years for that vegetation to fully grow back. So we still have four more rainy winters to worry about.
So what's been done to help keep people safe these next 4 years? Because, you know, that's not nothing. That's still we still have some time ahead of us here.
Well, fortunately, the most recent rains were good for vegetation returning and not for causing mudslides. Pat McElroy has retired from the fire department, but now he heads up a nonprofit called the Partnership for Resilient Communities, and their plan is to build debris nets.
Nets?
Yes, debris nets to catch debris flow. They look like giant fishing nets made of large metal rings, which are then like secured to the mountainside. They studied all the current options out there to protect it against mudslides, and metal nets were the best. So here's Pat again.
A lot of the stuff is either impractical, too expensive, too invasive. And we felt this was, in terms of an environmentally sensitive community like Santa Barbara, this is what we thought was our best option.
And just a few weeks ago, McElroy's group got the go-ahead to build 11 nets. They have 60 days to complete it from December 21st, and the total cost is $5.4 million with a $2 million bond on top of that, just in case they actually get used during the rainy seasons.
Now, where exactly are these nets getting installed?
Well, two of them are getting put up at Cold Springs Canyon, two at San Ysidro, and seven in Buena Vista Canyon near the base of those canyons.
And who actually makes these nets?
Well, there's a company called Access Limited out of Oceana, California. Right now, they have a total of 41 in operation around California. And McElroy's group is reaching out to affected folks from the Camp Fire up north and the Woolsey Fire in Malibu to urge them to look into doing the same thing.
I mean, it sounds like an interesting idea, but do they have a good success rate, these gnats?
They do, actually. In 2013, there was a fire in Camarillo called the Spring Fire, and a debris flow right afterwards destroyed houses in a gated community called Camarillo Springs. The city contracted with Access Limited. They installed some debris nets. And according to Pat McElroy, the next time it rained heavy, the nets caught everything.
Now, I mean, just thinking this through here, are we going to have to get used to looking up at the canyons and seeing big metal nets in the mountains? I just imagine that environmentalists could get a little upset about this, and potentially it disrupts some habitats, for example.
Well, the good thing is they're not permanent. There's another example where nets were installed above Avalon on Catalina Island, and after a fire threatened that town. But if you go there today, 5 years later, the nets are gone. The hillside grew back. In fact, McElroy's organization is mandated to remove the nets after 5 years, and they're changing where they're placing some of the nets because of environmentalists and hikers. But that 5 years is in the contract.
You know, just a moment ago, you mentioned that this is going to cost millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. So who's going to pay for it?
Well, some of the money is coming from wealthy but anonymous donors and upcoming state and FEMA funds. Originally, they had budgeted for 15 nets, but four of those are on federal land at Hot Springs and Romero Canyon. The approval for those four is still pending.
So we've been focusing on the Montecito area because, I mean, it got hit so badly a year ago. But the Thomas Fire was massive, and there were other hillsides that were scorched above areas like Goleta and Carpinteria. So what about places like those?
Yeah, well, for that, I spoke with Tom Farum, who oversees the County Flood Control District. He says it's really a matter of geography.
For one thing, Montecito's in a very precarious position because you go from 3,000-foot mountains to the ocean, and the urban area is very close to the apex of the hills, the base of the hills. In Carpinteria, it's a little bit different. The mountains, particularly the mountains where the fire was, are several miles inland.
And the same goes for Goleta. The mountains are set further back, so it's harder for those boulders to make their way to urban areas. But again, never say never.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big, complicated, and as we're finding out, expensive issue and project here. So as residents that live throughout this county, I mean, what are things that we can do?
Well, the only real thing is to be prepared and sign up for the county's Aware and Prepare service, so you know when there's emergency. So that's awareandprepare.org. Both Tom and Pat told me that several times. Sign up for it.
And as a county, I mean, how are we doing with this?
Well, according to a recent county report, less than a quarter of Santa Barbara County residents are signed up for the service. That percentage is higher in places like Summerland and Montecito, but it's still not where emergency officials want us to be.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't sound too good.
It doesn't sound good. Now, there is a state bill that will go in effect this year that will give counties the option to automatically enroll their residents into emergency message programs using phone number data, but that's still a ways off. So, folks, go sign up, awareandprepare.org. You never know what could happen. You just don't.
Ted Mills, thanks for the research and sharing this with us.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
And do you have a question about the Central Coast you want us to answer? Let us know at kcrw.com/curiouscoast. This is the 805. I'm Jonathan Bastian. Well, you may want to keep your raincoat handy, and not just this weekend. According to the National Weather Service, there's a 90% chance El Niño will form and hit the northern hemisphere this winter, and a 60% chance it will continue through the spring. So what does that mean for us here along the Central Coast, for the drought, and for areas susceptible to mudslides? To answer those questions, I'm joined by Samantha Stevenson. She's a professor at the Bren School of Environmental Sciences at UC Santa Barbara, where she focuses on extreme weather events. Thanks for being here.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. We throw around this term, it's going to be an El Niño winter, and we think that could mean more waves or wind, but what does it actually mean? What is an El Niño?
Yeah, it's a great question. So an El Niño is a feature of the climate, and it happens naturally every about 3 to 4 years. And what it means is that the eastern part of the tropical Pacific is warmer than normal, right? And so when you're talking about chances of an El Niño forming, that really means that we've defined some threshold of amount of warmer than usual that means that we're calling that an El Niño. But in general, the temperature in the Pacific oscillates from warmer to colder. And when it gets warm enough, we call it an El Nino.
Yeah.
And that has implications for weather and climate around the world.
Why does it get warmer every 3 to 5 years? Because it seems like it was only a couple years ago that we had another El Nino event.
Yeah, exactly. There was one in 2015 to 16. So the basic mechanism is that there's these trade winds that blow from east to west along the equator in the Pacific. And when those get weaker than normal, then that allows the warmer water that's normally trapped in the western part of the basin to kind of slosh over further into the east. And so that's why it warms up. And when it, like I said, when it warms up enough, then we call it an El Nino event.
Okay, yeah. So it appears that we could have one on our hands this winter. And what does this mean for us here in the Central Coast?
Most of the ocean is a little bit warmer than usual at the moment. And so that's why these advisories are coming out saying there's a 90% chance of an El Nino forming. What that means for us is a little bit unclear because every El Nino is somewhat different from every other one. So during 2015 to 16, it was a really, really strong El Nino. It was like 3 or 4 degrees above the average temperatures. It was one of the strongest events that's ever been recorded. And so people were very concerned about like whether or not we were going to have strong rainstorms in the south and central coasts. But it didn't really happen. And that's because there were warmer than normal temperatures over in the North Pacific, and that interfered with the changes to the weather patterns, and we ended up not getting the amount of rain that we expected to. So it's a little bit hard to say exactly what's going to happen here based on this coming El Nino. But if it kind of operates according to how we think normal El Ninos work, then we might expect to get more extreme rain.
But it is interesting that there are variations within an El Nino. I mean, it's not just like, okay, this is what it is, expect this, right? That there's a lot of room for, I don't know, different scenarios here.
Right. Yeah. So that kind of makes my job a little bit harder because right. I'd love to make a recommendation that would be perfect and tell you exactly what to expect. But it's a little bit trickier than that, unfortunately.
In general, though, I mean, we do think of wetter winters. We think of bigger waves. I mean, that's the kind of thing that could happen, though.
That's right. Yeah. So during an El Nino event, because you have these warm temperatures near the equator, it tends to steer the jet stream. So this band of really strong winds that blow from west to east along near the latitude of California, it pushes that further south. And that means that we get stronger onshore winds in the central and south coasts. And so that's what drives these more extreme rain events.
Yeah.
But this is a question of how strong that steering south will be and whether or not there's anything that could interfere with that.
I mean, as we're talking, we're seeing really what some are saying are kind of historic wave heights through California. It's been really crazy for those like me that love to spend the time in the ocean and surf. It's been spectacular being out there. Could that be a feature of an El Nino winter?
It could be, but again, it's going to depend on how many storm events we get. So the waves that you care about as a surfer are really driven by these weather events, right? So if you get a storm in a region it can be pretty far away from the coast too. So like it disturbs the ocean a little bit offshore, and then that propagates in and creates waves that are great for surfing. So we could expect more of that during this winter, but again, it's like really going to depend on what the weather wants to do.
Well, here in the Santa Barbara region, it seems like right now, or really over the past years, maybe stretching decades now, but particularly right now, we remain in a major drought. And when we hear El Nino, we think, oh, great, it's going to bring more rain. And we've seen that maybe it can in the past, but we're also straddling this kind of uncomfortable line because we want to fill these water basins. But, you know, at the same time, we also know that very serious rain can result in more debris flows. The Thomas Fire burn scar is massive, and we're hearing it could take another 4 years for the vegetation to grow back. So from what you're seeing, how likely is it that we could get a deluge again that could once again threaten structures and lives?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, it's very possible. It's all like the devil is in the details here, right? So we are very vulnerable to these types of extreme rainfall events. And if the rain is intense enough, right, that's the key for things like triggering mudslides. So it can rain all it wants, but if you don't get a rain intensity, so if it doesn't rain enough in, say, a 15-minute span, then we're not going to end up triggering a mudslide. And so then what that threshold is a little bit uncertain, but yeah, it's going to really depend on how many rainstorms hit the central coast, how intense that peak precipitation is within that storm. But yeah, I would say that statistically speaking, because we're in El Nino conditions or close to it, then we might want to be on the lookout for stronger rainstorms. And if we see those types of storms maybe approaching, then just be aware that there are these burn scars that still exist. And, you know.
So even though we don't quite know, it seems like there is a possibility.
Yeah, it is possible. And we do, I guess the one thing I should say is that we are probably going to be expecting these types of coupled drought plus extreme rainfall events. They're probably going to become more common in the future because as the Earth warms, we're going to get more moisture in the atmosphere, and that's going to tend to favor these types of really extreme rainstorms that have the potential to trigger debris flows.
Well, so that's what I was wondering, because just when I hear something like, well, this is partially the result of warmer ocean temperatures, I think. Is this the result of climate change? Is there a correlation here between El Nino and climate change?
Well, that's something that the climate community is still really working hard on, actually. We don't know exactly how strong El Niños are going to become in the future. All the models tend to disagree on that question. But what we can say is that when an El Nino happens, it's going to be on top of a warmer background state. Right. So the typical way we define an El Nino is how much warmer it is than average. But if average is warmer, then you're going to have an ocean that's just like a lot warmer during El Nino than it ever was during El Nino's past. Right. And so that's what the atmosphere cares about in terms of generating rain. So we expect that the impacts of these things are going to intensify, even though we don't know, you know, what exactly the ocean is going to be doing in terms of variability.
And to your earlier point, even if there's not an El Nino winter, we're still going to see more rain or more intense weather events, no matter what, moving forward.
It looks that way, yeah.
Samantha Stevenson is a professor at UC Santa Barbara at the Brand School, studies how climate change impacts the tropical Pacific and the drought here in the Southwest U.S. Thanks for being here.
Great, thanks so much.
Well, that's all for today. You've been listening to the 805 Stories from the Central Coast on KCRW. You can learn more at kcrw.com/the805 or download the show wherever you get your podcasts. The show was produced by Catherine Barnes. I'm Jonathan Dastian. We'll see you next week.